welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, science fiction. Later on, a classic. It's Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, adapted on the Hallmark Playhouse. But first, a story on X-1 penned by Wyman Gwyn called The Vopla. This August 27, 1957 broadcast was first heard on NBC.
Countdown for blast off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future. Adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company presents X-Vopla by Wyman Gwyn. But first, hear this.
What can you do with 43 cents? Not much? Don't you believe it. Because for 43 cents a year, you, as an American taxpayer, are a member of the greatest organization ever contrived by man to protect the peace, safeguard the rights of men and women throughout the world, maintain justice, and promote social progress. This organization is the United Nations, man's best hope for a better world. And it costs you only 43 cents a year.
Now, X-minus 1 and Vopla.
I'll be right there.
Oh, come on, you old hermit. I have a buffet on the terrace.
I'm coming. So, I'm an old hermit, am I? And our daughter says I'm eccentric now. I wonder how the devil she ever found out.
From me, of course.
But you love me just the same.
Oh, Max, what's got into you? Stop it.
Well, I reached the dangerous age. And, lady, I'm going to have fun.
Well, come on out to the terrace. The hamburgers will get cold.
My dear, I'm going to have a new kind of fun.
Oh?
It's a joke. I'm going to play a tremendous joke on the whole world. I had been working for this moment for 10 years, and now, Vopla's, three of them, a male and two females. I had called them Vopla's since that day 10 years ago when I got the idea of creating a flying mutant, which I would teach to feed, play, and talk. Now I was almost ready to play my joke on the world. After lunch, when I returned to the lab, the Vopla's were moving about on the mattress where I had placed them, and the male was trying to stand. They were about 28 inches high. Except for the face, chest, and belly, the Vopla's were covered with a soft, almost golden down. The skin was pink. Upon his head and across his shoulders, the male had a shock of fur as soft as a chinchilla. The cranium was in the same proportion to the body as it is in the human. And they were shockingly human-eyed. When the male spread his arms, the span was 48 inches. I held his arms out and tried to tease the spars open. These spars turned backward and ran alongside the wrist almost to the elbow. Powerful wrist muscles could snap them outward and forward. Suddenly, as I teased the male Vopla, this happened. The spars shot outward, adding 9 inches to each side of his span. The lateral skin, that had until now been resting in folds was tightened into a golden plane that stretched from the tip of the spar to his waist. A true gliding plane, perhaps even a soaring plane. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, they were ready for their first solid food. Come on now, here, hold the cup. That's the way. Hold the cup. Oh, you're a beauty. You're all beauties. No, come on. Hey, don't climb on my back. No, stop. Oh, that's better. Oh, hello, pretty one. Hello.
Hello.
So that's the way it's going to be, eh? Hello.
Hello.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, you have no idea what I have in store for you, my dears. I will teach you a language. Perhaps English, or simple basic English. You will have your own crafts, and you'll live in small tree houses, and I'll teach you legends that you came from the stars, that you watched the red men and the white men, and you listened to their speech. And when you're able to take care of yourselves, I'll turn you loose. There'll be Volpla colonies up and down the coast before anyone suspects. And then, my dear, one day, somebody will see a Volpla, and the scientists will observe them. Then the legends will come. Isn't that funny? Don't you think that's terribly funny?
Funny. You're listening to Volpla on X-1. When you drive, have you ever thought there ought to be a law to make driving safer? Well, there are such laws, but in fatal traffic accidents, about 61% of the drivers were violating at least one of those laws at the time of the accident. Are these drivers maniacs and stupid fools? At times it seems like it, but many of them were average people who just took a chance and lost. Many of them probably knew they were violating the law at the time, but it gave them a distorted feeling of power to know that they could cheat on the law. These traffic laws were not enacted to trap you or deprive you of your rights and liberties. No, they were written into the books for just two reasons: to help you drive safely and to protect you from those who could and would endanger your life if there were no laws. The National Safety Council urges you to back the attack on traffic accidents, stay within the law, and stay alive. Now back to X-1 and Act 2 of Volpla.
I used the metabolic accelerator to cut the Volpla's gestation down to 1 week, and I used it to bring the infants to maturity in 1 month. By the next spring, I had a colony of over 100 Volplas, and I shut down the accelerator. From now on, they could have their babies in their own way. I had devised a language for them, and I carefully adulterated it with English, as if they had observed us and learned. My Volplas were amazing. They were bilingual. Now, Jane and Susie went down to Santa Barbara for a week, and I took the opportunity to ship the male and the oldest two females out of the lab. I put them in a jeep beside me and drove to a secluded valley about a mile back on the ranch.
Tree, rock, sky.
That's right, Chief. That's the sky. All right, come on now. Everybody out. Run, jump.
Jump. Run, sky.
That's right. Take off. Go ahead. He spent about 2 hours chasing the two girl Volplas around, and then he made a leap for one. And when he spread his arms, his spars snapped out, and those golden planes sheared into the air.
Sky!
He sailed over her, and he rose up, and he hung in the breeze for a long moment, 3 feet above the ground.
Fly!
That's right! You can fly!
Help! Fly!
They learned quickly and brilliantly. They were not really flyers. They were gliders and soarers. Before long, they took agilely to the trees and launched themselves in beautiful glides for hundreds of feet, banking and turning and spiraling to a gentle halt. Oh, I laughed out loud with anticipation. Wait until the first pair of these is brought before a sheriff. Wait till the newspaper reporters are routed out into the hills to witness this. When they were tired, the Volplas lay on their backs with their planes stretched out. The oldest one came over to me. He squatted, his elbows resting in the ground, his wrist crossed at his chest.
Before the red men, we live here?
That's right. In places like these, you lived all along these mountains. Now there are very few of you left. Since you've been staying in my place, you've naturally forgotten the ways of living outdoors.
We learn again. We stay here?
That's right. Now look. Look, you see up on that tree? That's a bird. That's your food, if you can kill it.
How?
Well, I don't think you can get at them in the tree. You'll have to soar up above and catch one of them on the wing when they fly away. Go ahead, try. He climbed the tree and launched himself and caught a warm updraft from the hillside. In no time, he was about 200 feet away. He began working his way, crisscrossing back to us. And then suddenly he dived. He caught the bird. He caught the bird.
Bird! 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 We eat!
Yes. Yes, you eat this. I'll show you how to build a fire. Again, I told them the story I had made up. How they came long before the red men in a ship from the stars. I taught them to point to the planet Venus and say that was the star they came from. And I grinned to think of the many stories that would be written in the Sunday supplements. Oh, what a great joke I was playing on the world.
We came from a star before the red men? From a star?
Yes, yes. The next week, I brought all the Volplas out to the oak wood. There were 107 men, women, and children. By the end of the week, they were scattered over 4 square miles of the ranch. They hunted sparrows and cooked them over tiny fires. The little creatures delighted me more and more. For hours, I could watch them play. I could sit all afternoon and watch them at work in a treehouse, quite forgetting to go home.
Well, how does the mighty hunter who now returns from the forest?
Fine. Oh, I've been enjoying the local animal life.
So is our daughter.
What do you mean?
She has 2 of them up in her room.
2 what?
I don't know. What do you call them?
I went up the stairs 3 at a time and burst into my daughter's room. There she sat in her bed, reading a book to 2 Volplas.
Hello there, King Arthur.
What's going on here?
Oh, nothing, Daddy. We're just reading like we always do.
Like always? How long has this been going on?
Oh, weeks and weeks. How long is it since that first time you came here to visit me?
Weeks and weeks.
But you're teaching them to read.
Oh, of course. They're such good pupils and so grateful. Daddy, you won't make them go away, will you?
Oh, Jane, why didn't you tell me such a thing like this was going on?
Now, you listen to me, mister. Your whole life is a secret from us. Just what makes you think your daughter can't have a little secret of her own?
Oh, fine secret. Didn't it occur to you that this might be dangerous? Those creatures are...
Oh, Max, for heaven's sake, they're sweet, lovable little creatures without a harm in their furry little bodies. Now, don't get excited.
Chief! Chief! Look, where are you?
Here, Bush!
Listen. Listen, do you realize there are 2 Volplas in my daughter's bedroom?
Yes, they go there every day. Is there anything wrong with that?
But she's teaching them the words men put on paper.
Yes, you told us men may be enemies. We wish to learn so we can protect. I have Thing here.
Well, that's the San Francisco Chronicle.
We've been taking it for some time from Box at your house.
Oh.
I have learned from the others. I can read most of this.
It was terrible. The whole wonderful joke of the Volplas would be lost. But I knew what I would have to do. I'd have to, well, I'd have to explain that my family and I had found a colony of them in our ranch and taught them English and taught them to read. I was stuck with that.
Men are dangerous. They will shoot us with guns if we leave here.
No. Now listen. When they know who you are, they'll leave you alone. Now, you must disperse all your families at once. Send them far away and spread out.
No, we cannot leave these woods. Men would shoot us.
But I'm telling you...
Perhaps you are not a good friend. Perhaps you have lied to us. Why are you saying we should leave these woods?
But it's important. The whole... I mean, you'll be safer.
We will decide.
The whole thing was critical. It could be disastrous. I went back to the house and up to Susie's room. I found her talking to two Volplas.
Oh, no. I'm sure you didn't come from the stars. That doesn't sound right. The more I think about it, the more I'm sure that my father made you.
Susie, what business have you telling them that? I don't want you talking to them that way, do you hear me?
Daddy, you want to play a joke, don't you? Like the time you said I could have a horse for my birthday. You gave me that dried seahorse in the bottle instead of a real one. Were you going to make that kind of a joke?
No, Susie, honey, that isn't exactly it, no.
I don't think it's very funny. The Volplers are my friends. I wouldn't want to play a practical joke on them.
Chief, where are you? Chief!
Oh, confound it, the fires are out, none of them around.
Chief, are you up there in that treehouse? Where are you? Where are all of you? You've got to listen to me. I made you. The joke, the whole joke is spoiled. Where are you? Chief! Volplas! Volplas!
I was away from the house for hours. When I came back, I found Jane sitting on the terrace.
Are you looking for something, dear?
Oh, never mind.
I suppose they're all gone.
What do you mean?
The little flying thing. I saw them fly by about 4 in the afternoon.
You did? Where did they go?
Over that way. You could see them soaring over the trees. Oh, it was so pretty.
Well, where's Susie?
She's been watching television. She's all excited about the rocket flight, you know.
What rocket?
Oh, you have been living in the woods. The Venus rocket. My goodness, it's been in all the newspapers. Well, where are you going?
Well, I've got to talk to Susie. Susie!
Shh, Daddy, the rocket's almost ready to go. Listen.
It approaches 0 hour now. The rocket stands tall and silvery. The gantry crane is pulled away now. We're actually at least 5 miles away, watching from the remote monitors. Some disturbance now. It seems to be some birds. Big birds, like a flock of owls, circling the ship.
Oh, Daddy, look!
Hey, wait a minute. They're flying through the hatch. It seems to be jammed open. This is certainly an unforeseen development. The men on the ground are driving a motor-driven ladder up to the ship, and the owls seem to be fighting them off. Oh, there goes the hatch. It's closed. Those birds are inside. They're big birds, big as eagles. As we told you previously, ladies and gentlemen, the rocket is on automatic fire. It'll go off in precisely 10 seconds.
We stared at the television screen. We saw the red blast of fire and the silvery rocket streak up into the sky, the cameras following.
Our reporter at scientific headquarters reports that none of the rocket's telemeters are recording. The owls who blundered into the open hatch in this heartbreaking accident seem to have disrupted the automatic recorders. The control circuit cannot be altered. The rocket will land on Venus as scheduled.
Daddy, those weren't owls, were they?
No, they weren't.
Owls? He thought they were owls. That's kind of a joke, isn't it? Isn't it a joke, Daddy?
I say, Max, dear, the joke's on you. Wait till men land on Venus and find Venusians with a legend about their great father in California.
Of course, they left me a note. The handwriting wasn't very good, but then you wouldn't write very well either if your index finger was 9 inches long. I sat in the patio and read the Volpla's farewell. It said, "The man who made us, we forgive you. We know we did not come from the stars, but we go there. I, the chief, give you welcome to visit. We will try not to laugh at you. Goodbye."
X Minus One has brought you Volpla, a story written by Wyman Gwynn and adapted for radio by Ernest Kanoy. Featured in our cast were Nelson Olmsted as the scientist, Ann Petoniak as his wife Jane, Adele Newton as his daughter Susie. This is Fred Collins. X Minus One was directed by George Voutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
We pause now for station identification.
X Minus One on Tuned to Yesterday from August 29th, 1957 on NBC. You're listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Next, the Hallmark Playhouse adapts the 1870 novel penned by Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Known as one of literature's early science fiction classics, it was translated from the original French to English 3 years after its publication, apparently replete with errors. Many of the French words were translated improperly from what we know today. For instance, a scuba suit or diving apparatus was referred to as a cork jacket. Although a proper or more accurate translation wasn't published until 1966, in the eyes of the American public, Walt Disney did one better by producing a film based on the story in 1954, featuring Kirk Douglas, Peter Lorre, Ted DeCorsia, and James Mason as Captain Nemo. What we'll hear next is a radio adaptation before that picture was even made, with Raymond Burr starring as Captain Nemo, heard first on November 8, 1951 on CBS.
Remember, a Hallmark card when you care enough to send the very best. Tonight from Hollywood, the makers of Hallmark greeting cards bring you Louis Jourdan in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea on the Hallmark Playhouse. Each week, Hallmark will bring you Hollywood's greatest stars in outstanding stories chosen by one of the world's best-known authors, the distinguished novelist, Mr. James Hilton.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is James Hilton. I wonder whether there was one book which you read when you were quite young that you still remember with special affection. The story we dramatize on our Hallmark Playhouse tonight is one I could say this about in my own life. It's Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It was, as I remember it, just the sort of story to excite a boy who was born into this 20th century of scientific adventure. And when I reread it a short time ago, it held for me something of the same old fascination. Jules Verne, who, you could say, was really one of the pioneers of science fiction, never did anything better than 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And of all his novels, it's probably the one which for us today has a thoroughly modern ring. To play our hero's part tonight, we are introducing to you a fine actor who has become one of Hollywood's popular favorites, Louis Jourdan. And now here is Frank Goss from the makers of Hallmark cards.
One of the particular joys of Christmas is sending and receiving Christmas cards. While the pleasure Christmas cards bring can never be measured, isn't it good to know that Hallmark cards are priced the same this year as they were last year, and the year before, and the year before that? And that the quality of Hallmark cards has constantly improved throughout the years. Yes, today, just as for many Christmas seasons, that Hallmark on the back of your card is looked for and welcomed. It tells your friends you cared enough to send the very best. And now, Hallmark Playhouse, presenting Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, starring Louis Jourdan.
that which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? The book of Ecclesiastes asked that question over 2,000 years ago. And today, in this age of science, the mysteries of the deep are still unsolved. 3/4 of the Earth's surface, when you come to reckon it, lies buried beneath billions of tons of water. There, in the plunging miles below the waves, what wonders lie in the blackness? Nearly a century ago, a Frenchman named Jules Verne let loose his imagination among those terrifying secrets, the dark, measureless caverns of the ocean floor. It is there we shall follow him tonight.
Professor Aronnax, thank you for coming to my office.
My pleasure, Commodore Farragut. But how can a botanist be of help to you?
Professor, do you know how the steamship Moravian was sunk?
I was under the impression that it had scraped on a submerged reef.
Where the Moravian sank, the ocean depth is greater than 100 fathoms.
Astonishing.
And when the steamship Scotia limped into dry dock at Liverpool, there was a triangular gash in her hull, which couldn't have been done more neatly with a metal punch. Professor Aronnax, the Scotia was rammed.
But, Commodore, if this is true, it is an act of war. No vessels on the high seas are safe.
I do not believe that this is the work of a human being. I believe that these disasters are the work of some beast of the ocean depths. A giant whale, perhaps, uncatalogued in your books of science.
It might be some species of Monodon monoceros with a long spiral tooth like a unicorn.
You see, Professor, it's for such knowledge that you'll be valuable to our expedition.
What is your plan, Commodore?
To comb the oceans to find your sea monster, Professor, harpoon it and make the shipping lanes safe again.
When do you sail?
Friday at dawn.
I'll be aboard, sir. It sounds like quite an adventure. Months later, I was cursing myself for making such a hasty decision. For 3 long months, we had seesawed back and forth across the oceans. But there was no sign of the sea monster. The crew was restless. We slept fitfully, for we never knew when the tusk of the great beast might rip into our hull and send us to the bottom.
I wouldn't worry about it, Professor.
What's the matter, Ned?
Well, if you ask me, I think this is a wild goose chase with no wild goose.
What makes you say that?
All my life, I've been chasing whales. I've never seen one that's big enough to sink an ocean steamship.
Ned! Ned! What would you say that is?
Where?
Off the starboard. That black object coming toward us.
Lord, save us. I've never seen anything like it.
Commodore, did you see that?
Yes, we've spotted it. Lieutenant, order battle stations. Ned Land?
Aye, aye, sir.
Take your position. We're depending on you to harpoon this creature.
Aye, sir. I'll do my best.
Good man. Professor?
Yes, Commodore.
Look at the speed of that devil.
It's beyond belief.
By heaven, it's heading straight toward us. Helm?
Aye, sir.
Swing to so we're facing the devil head on.
Aye, sir.
Shall I harpoon when I'm ready, sir?
Don't wait for a command.
Look.
It's a whale, all right.
What a water spout.
Ah, Shiva!
Hold fast, men. That water's going to break over the ship. Hold fast!
The whale spouted a torrent of water which broke over our ship. I was thrown over the rail and fell into the sea. I popped like a cork on the surface of an ocean 2 miles deep. By the time I could see and utter a cry, our ship had swirled out of earshot. I knew that it would be a matter of minutes before I was a dead man. The nearest bit of earth was 2 miles away, straight down.
Don't struggle so hard, Professor.
Ned Land. Well, we can drown together.
Well, that won't be necessary, Professor. If you reach down, I think you'll find solid footing directly beneath you.
Good Lord, Ned, this is a miracle.
No, sir, it's our whale.
What?
Keep your balance, sir. It's heaving up out of the water.
This is no whale.
I'd say it was a regular ironclad.
You're right. These are iron plates riveted together. There must be men inside. Human beings with human sympathies. Now, pick on the shell, Ned, with your knife. Come
right,
on.
Sir, right.
Let us in. Let us in.
Help us, you pirates! Save us! Let us in!
Suddenly, one of the iron plates was lifted up. A man looked out, stared at us for a moment, and disappeared. A few moments later, four strong men with masked faces appeared noiselessly and carried us down inside their formidable machine.
Professor Aronnax.
Yes, Ned. Are you all right?
These bruisers don't stand much of a ceremony, do they? Dumping us down here where it's blacker than pitch.
Yeah, we're completely at their mercy.
I still have my knife. Listen.
Someone's coming now. There, in the doorway, stood the strangest man I have ever seen. He carried an electric lantern, which cast sharp shadows on his face. It was a face which might have belonged to an Old Testament prophet. His physique was magnificent. And his age, well, the man might have been 35 or 60. For at least a full minute, he stood in the doorway, examining us without a word.
Well, why are you standing there just looking at us? If it's a fight you want,
now, Ned, control yourself. Sir, we don't know who you are or what you intend to do with us. My name is Pierre Aronnax. I am a professor of marine biology with the National Museum in Paris. This is Master Ned Land, harpooner, United States Navy. We call upon your humanity to treat us as you would wish to be treated in a similar circumstance.
He doesn't seem to understand.
Monsieur, je vous demande pardon. Je suis Pierre Aronnax, professeur de biologie.
That will suffice, gentlemen. We will discuss these matters in whatever tongue you choose. I myself speak 13 languages.
Then we'll talk in plain English.
As you wish. Mr. Land, Monsieur Aronnax, I am very annoyed to see you. An unkind fate has brought you here to trouble my existence.
Unintentionally.
Unintentionally? Was it unintentionally that your vessel pursued me halfway around the world? Gentlemen, you set sail with the single purpose of destroying me. Is there any reason, then, why I should show you hospitality? Might not I place you outside on my deck, then sink beneath the waters and forget that you ever existed? Is that not my right?
It might be the right of a savage, but not the right of a civilized man.
I am not what you call a civilized man. I have done with society entirely. Therefore, I do not obey its laws.
If you wish to kill us, please make the death swift and merciful.
I have no such intention. Professor Aronnax, I have read several of your books on biology and deep sea life.
Oh.
And because of my admiration for your scientific knowledge and your learning, I've decided that you and your companion are to remain aboard this vessel.
To whom are we indebted for this clemency?
I am no one to you, and that is just what you are to call me, Captain Nemo.
You mean we're prisoners?
On the contrary, Mr. Land, you will be my honored guests. You will be free to move at will from stem to stern of my ship, which I call the Nautilus. I will show you its wonders and its ingenious mechanisms.
But, Captain Nemo, you have said we are your enemies. Aren't you afraid that we will take this knowledge back to our homes and use it to destroy you?
That doesn't worry me in the slightest, because I promise you, gentlemen, that neither of you will ever leave this vessel alive.
In just a moment, we will return to the second act of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, starring Louis Jourdan. I read somewhere once that Christmas is a lot of little things. And when you stop to think about it, isn't it the little things that make our memories of Christmas so vivid?
Most are impressions of childhood. The star atop the tree. A whiff of goodness as the Christmas cookies come from the oven. A candle in the window on Christmas Eve. The memories are different for each of us, but you can share Christmas memories with your friends by seeing that your Christmas card represents your feelings about Christmas. This is much easier to do than it sounds, for you'll find that the Hallmark Christmas card collection is so varied, so complete, that you're sure to find the one card that brings forth your most vivid memory. Choose it and make it your own. In the Hallmark album are cards you can order imprinted with your name. In addition, you'll find Hallmark cards in many convenient boxed collections awaiting your personal signature. They're designed to express your Christmas wishes in a beautiful manner and yet are priced to fit even the most limited budget. And for every Hallmark Christmas card you send your friends, add that pleasant feeling of knowing it will be well received. For that Hallmark on the back tells them you cared enough to send the very best. Now back to James Hilton in the second act of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, starring Louis Jourdan.
Tonight we are traveling as guests of the enigmatic Captain Nemo aboard his submarine, the Nautilus.
May I say, Captain Nemo, that I have never had a better meal in the finest hotels in Europe.
Thank you.
You must pick up delicacies at every port.
I visit no ports. I make no contact with your world. You have eaten the harvest of the sea.
Remarkable.
Shall we go to the library?
You have a library on board?
12,000 volumes.
Unbelievable.
Come, see for yourself. These bookshelves contain the gleanings of the richest minds that have lived on this planet. Your works among them, sir.
I am honored. Oh, you even have a piano.
Of course.
Do you play?
A little. As you listen, my friend, I ask you to consider this question. Where do you think you are?
Why? In the library of your vessel, of course. Floating on the sea.
No, Professor, not floating. Be so good as to slide that panel to your left. So. Look.
Behind the panel lay a window of plate glass. And in the faint light of deep underwater, I saw whole armies of fish swim by the Nautilus. Scores of fabulous creatures of the deep.
They are attracted in such numbers by the lamps we steer by.
But, Captain, where do you get your power to travel at such speeds?
The sea supplies me with all the electricity I need through the chemical disintegration of seawater. My own invention.
You love the sea, Captain?
Yes. Yes, I love it. The sea is everything. Its breath is pure and healthy. It is an immense desert where man is never lonely, for he feels life stirring on all sides. The sea does not belong to tyrants and despots. Upon its surface, men can still fight and tear one another to pieces, but here, beneath the surface of the sea, the power of the tyrant ceases. Here is independence. Here, I am free.
But a man must be wealthy to live such a life. Are you rich?
I could, without missing it, pay the national debt of France.
Some days later, I found a note on the table of my stateroom. Captain Nemo invites Professor Aronnax to a hunting party, which will take place this morning in the forests of Atlantis. A sunken civilization.
That is correct. Monsieur Aronnax, as soon as we don these diving helmets, I shall be pleased to show you the ruins of a lost continent, Atlantis.
Atlantis.
We will be able to talk with each other over a telephone apparatus, and there is plenty of air to breathe. It's compressed in this little tank which you carry on your back. Here, Professor, let me help you. Can you hear me, Professor?
Yes. Yes, fine. Can you hear me, Captain Nemo?
Perfectly. Now, if you will follow me through this door, Professor. You know, the ground upon which you are walking was, many centuries ago, dry land. Then there was an upheaval within the earth, and this island sank beneath the waves of the Atlantic.
That red glow ahead of us, what is it?
It is lava, sir. We are climbing up the slope of an active volcano.
The red glow grew brighter, and I found myself on the brink of an undersea volcano with a crater pouring white-hot rock into the sea. There was a hail of volcanic debris descending in slow motion through the water. And at the foot of the mountain, before my very eyes, lay a town, ruined, destroyed, its roofs open to the watery sky, its temples fallen, its marble columns lying on the ground. Here was another Pompeii, the city which had died a double death, stricken by both fire and water.
It is dangerous to go nearer.
The lost city of Atlantis.
Ah, I had almost forgotten. I promised you a hunt. Look to your left.
A sunken ship. A Spanish galley.
Yes. What do you suppose you will find on board?
I can imagine.
Here. Some of it seems to have spilled over the side. Here, Professor Aronnax.
A solid ingot of gold.
Kindly accept this trifle, Professor, as a token of esteem from your friend, Captain Nemo.
How much is this worth?
In your world, perhaps 1,000,000 francs. Down here, the fish place its value at exactly nothing.
A few days later, the Nautilus came to the surface to restore its supply of air. The Ned and I were enjoying a quick stroll on deck.
Look, sir, over there, a ship.
Now, I can't make out the flag she's flying.
What are you doing above decks? I command you to go below.
You can't command us.
Captain Nemo, I ask you to address us as gentlemen, not as underlings.
You have seen things which you should not see. For your own good, gentlemen, I tell you to go below.
They're firing at us.
Oh, ship of an accursed nation, you know who I am. You whose people took from me everything I loved. I do not need your colors to know you by.
Sir, are you going to attack this vessel?
Attack it? Sir, I am going to sink it. Go below!
Through the heavy glass window of the library, I saw that we had submerged. Then a shock passed through the Nautilus, and the whole submarine shuddered with a frightful impact. Then, through my window, I watched a dreadful sight. I saw a stricken vessel sinking below the waves. There was tense breathing next to me. It was Captain Nemo. Suddenly, he seemed overcome by remorse. He ran to a desk, pulled out a drawer, took something from it. Then he fell to the floor, sobbing, clasping it close to his breast.
Forgive me. Forgive me.
He stretched out his arms. He was holding a picture. A picture of a beautiful woman with two little children.
Forgive me, my darlings. But now, you are avenged.
Are we on the surface, Professor?
Yes, Ned. And only a few hundred yards from shore.
Garth, if we're ever going to get off this cursed vessel, we'll have to do it tonight.
Everyone on board should be asleep by now. Now, we'll have to cross the library in order to get up on deck.
Yeah, lead the way.
All right.
Quiet, he's there.
see us in the shadows.
Hurry and be quiet.
Good evening, gentlemen. Isn't this a rather late hour to be wandering in the library?
We may as well tell you the truth, Captain. We were attempting to escape.
Well, for what other purpose do you suppose we are floating so close to the shore?
You mean you'll let us leave the Nautilus?
Perhaps the Nautilus is leaving you.
What does this mean, Captain?
A few miles to the north of us is a peculiar phenomenon called the Maelstrom.
The Maelstrom?
A whirlpool which draws ships into its vortex and smashes them in its whirling fury. Even now, gentlemen, our course is set for the dead center of the Maelstrom.
You'll be destroyed.
Naturally.
Now come with us. Save yourself.
No, my friends. I have lived long enough with bitterness. Everything must have an end. Somewhere. Some way. Go on. Up the companionway. I will not hinder you.
Captain Nemo, I beg you. Come with us.
Please, gentlemen. Do not interrupt me. I must finish my composition.
I hesitated a moment only, then hurried up the companionway to the deck. Ned and I dived into the icy water and swam to the shore, where we found shelter in a fisherman's hut. Exhausted, I tried to sleep, but my mind kept traveling out to the sea, toward that whirlpool, that deadly vortex, the Maelstrom. And all that night, I dreamed of the Nautilus being sucked into its grave. And though I don't remember it, Ned says that I woke up suddenly from my sleep, shouting at the top of my lungs, "Goodbye! Goodbye, Captain Nemo! Sleep well at the bottom of your sea!"
Jordan and James Hilton will return in a moment. Whatever you want your Christmas card to say to your friends, whether you want the chuckling good humor of Santa surrounded with toys or the quiet dignity and peace of a village church in a snow-filled valley, you'll find it expressed on a Hallmark Christmas card. And expressed so beautifully, your card will be the one your friends will single out to show to others, or tie on the tree, or place on the mantle. That's because on Hallmark cards, you'll find Christmas at its warmest. In the works of such artists as Norman Rockwell, Winston Churchill, Grandma Moses, and other equally outstanding gallery artists. When you're selecting your cards for personal imprinting, ask to see the Hallmark album. There you'll find the card you'll want for your very own. The one that says Merry Christmas to your friends, the way you'd like to say it personally. And remember, that Hallmark on the back of your card also says something to your friends. It tells them you cared enough to send the very best. Here again is James Hilton.
Thank you, Louis Jordan. We all enjoyed your performance, and we hope you return to our Hallmark Playhouse often, now that you've made your initial appearance.
It was a great pleasure to be here, Mr. Hilton. I've enjoyed every play I've heard on your Hallmark Playhouse. And right now, I feel a special fondness for your friendly Hallmark cards.
Special fondness? How's that, Louis?
Well, we have a baby boy at our house, born just last month. And I know how happy my wife and I were to receive each card that arrived. It made me feel as if I was free to talk all I wanted to about the baby, and that other folks were interested in him, too.
Well, somebody once said that the essence of friendship is thoughtfulness. And it always makes us happy when we discover it for ourselves, doesn't it?
It surely does. What are you planning for the Hallmark Playhouse next week?
Next week, we shall tell an exciting story based upon the life of the fabulous financial wizard of the 18th century, John Law, when we dramatize Emerson Hough's novel, The Mississippi Bubble. And as our star, we are delighted to have Ray Milland. Our Hallmark Playhouse is every Thursday. Our producer-director is Bill Gay. Our music is composed and conducted by David Rose. And our story tonight was dramatized by Lawrence and Lee.
Until next Thursday, then, this is James Hilton saying good night.
Look for Hallmark cards that are sold only in stores that have been carefully selected to give you expert and friendly service. Remember, a Hallmark card when you care enough to send the very best. Louis Jordan appeared tonight through the courtesy of 20th Century Fox Studios and may currently be seen in a Technicolor production, Anne of the Indies. The role of Captain Nemo tonight was played by Raymond Burr. Tom Tully was Ned Land and Norman Field, Commodore Farragut. This is Frank Goss saying goodnight to you all until next week at the same time when Hallmark Playhouse returns to present Raymond Land in Emerson Hough's Mississippi Bubble. And the week following, on Thanksgiving Day, Fanny Kilburn's The Widened Hearth, starring Ann Harding. And the week after that, Bellamy and Helen Partridge's Salad Days on the Hallmark Playhouse. This is the CBS Radio Network.
The Hallmark Playhouse, untuned to yesterday with an adaptation of that classic story, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, heard on CBS on November 8, 1951. And that brings the curtain down on this hour of sci-fi, untuned to yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.